Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
I tell you the truth, sometimes I wear a thin mask, and I'm getting too old to hide it, and I'm getting too old to fight, and all these fears and these feelings I've held inside, and I'm getting too old to fight.
How's everybody doing tonight? Tonight's music by the Salty Dogs. Y'all like the Salty Dogs? The Salty Dogs have shared the stage with Willie Nelson, Kinky Friedman, Hank Williams Jr., and many more. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to a very special edition of Tales from the South, a monthly series we call the Tin Roof Project, where well-known Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, all right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark has performed at the legendary King Biscuit Blues Festival in Helena, Arkansas, among many other festivals nationwide. He wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week.
And how about our set back here? Tonight, our featured artist is Byron Werner with his fine art Gickley print of his collage of bluesman Robert Johnson right here, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about these prints and Byron at our website, talesfromthesouth.com.
All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling?
Leah Thorvason is a renowned elite distance runner. She has a career marked by continued success at all distances and frequently sets course records in her favorite distance, the marathon. To date, she has won the women's field in over 10 marathons and ultras. After qualifying for the 2012 U.S. Olympic Women's Team Marathon Trials, but not making the Olympic team, she built the longest winning streak of any distance runner in the world, according to statistics compiled by Race Results Weekly and the Association of Road Racing Statisticians, by winning 12 races in a row, including 5 standard marathons, setting 9 course records, and posting the 4th fastest women's 50-mile time in U.S. history. In 2 of the races, Thorvason was the overall winner, beating all of the men. In October 2012, she was invited to be one of only 50 elite women runners in the New York Marathon. Leah has appeared in and been featured in multiple local, regional, and national magazine and news programs. Originally from Robbinsdale, Minnesota, Leah has made her home in Little Rock, Arkansas for the past 14 years. Tonight, Leah takes us back to a day that she will never forget in heart and soul. Ladies and gentlemen, Leah Thorvason.
On January 16, 2012, next to a tiny photo on the front page of the sports section of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, the words "Thorvason fails to qualify for Olympic team" were printed. This was the manner in which my run at the Olympic Trials Marathon was summarized and immortalized by the press. I remember the day quite a bit differently. It was 7 a.m. when my coach Gary knocked on my hotel room door, seconds before I opened it. "You ready to go?" he said. All I could do was nod. I had been preparing for this day for years, and all that was bouncing around in my head was, oh my God, I'm really here. It was the Olympic trials, and all 300 to 400 elite men and women runners, including me, congregated in a sectioned-off area of Houston's George R. Brown Convention Center, waiting for the race to begin. Some of them were sitting calmly, Others were stretching. Others were lying on the ground with their legs propped up along the wall. I was just trying not to look painfully out of place and nervous. In hindsight, I'm quite certain that everyone else there was way too caught up in their own state of mind and preparation to give a damn about me. But at the moment, I was really self-conscious. Does everyone notice that my shoes are a different brand from my gear, which is a different brand from my bag? The marks of an athlete not sponsored by one of the big name companies. Do the old bag check tags I have sentimentally left dangling from my backpack make me look unprofessional? What about my lucky plastic pickle safety pinned to my shoe? I'm not built like a marathoner. I have stupid hair. What am I supposed to be doing right now? Should I be stretching? I don't ever stretch before I run. Yeah, I should be stretching. I need to look like I have a routine, like I have my stuff together. The trials course was set up as one 2.2-mile loop, followed by three times around an 8-mile loop to get the total 26.2 miles. The men started off their 2.2-mile loop while the women were held in a corral waiting. This is where my monologue continued. Should I do some drills? Everyone else is doing drills. I don't ever do drills. Just keep running in circles. Do a few stride outs. Is it close to time to go? Should I take off my warm-ups yet? It's too early to take off my warm-ups. I need to adjust the laces on my shoes. I need to take off my gloves. I don't want to be in the way of everyone. Where can I go to fix my shoes? Where's Gary? He has my goose. I need to pee. I don't have time to pee. Should I try to go pee real quick? Seriously? I don't remember hearing commands to the men or women to move towards the start, just the motion of all of us moving as a crowd. Someone yelled to me from the sidelines. A lot of the details are a blur, but in typical fashion, I turned and stuck out my tongue at whoever it was. I only know this because there's a photo of it. A couple dozen women around me, all straight-faced, eyes ahead, focused, and me, like a Where's Waldo of the women's Olympic trials. I crossed over the starting mats, hearing the beep, 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 beep of the timing chips. Here we go. Gary and I had discussed a race plan. We decided that unless the women just went balls to the wall from the beginning, it would be fun to try to stay with the pack for that first loop, soak up the experience of the trials. After that, see how I felt and see what the leaders were doing. In the beginning, the pace was slow. So slow that it was almost uncomfortable. I felt like I was practically stepping on the women in front of me and had company so close on my sides, I really couldn't jockey for a better position. When we got to the first mile, the time was close to 6:20. For a race where the winners are going to average around 5:30 per mile, I knew that this meant a hard break would happen at some point. It was just a matter of when. The break came quickly, and I tried to move with the pack. With marathons, I usually get a sense pretty early on about how the race is going to go. Either it feels great, and it's a matter of keeping that delicious energy in check for 26.2 miles, or it doesn't feel so great, and it's going to be a long haul. Unfortunately, the feeling I had on the day of the trials was that it was not likely to be my greatest day. I hoped I was wrong. Why couldn't I have my greatest run be on the biggest stage of my life? Hadn't we timed the workouts perfectly around it? Hadn't I rested enough? Sometimes you can lay things out just right, and your body still doesn't want to work with you. I had anticipated every inch of the race course would be crowded with people. You figure there are 14,000 runners participating in the Houston Marathon the next day. Wouldn't all of them be out be watching the trials? While my 25 through the finish was packed, the majority of the course seemed sparsely populated. Because of this, it wasn't difficult to spot my friends in the crowd. PT and Stan, shirtless, with L and T painted on their chests. Jesse and Kristen, standing with their signs in the Cabrini Green section of the course, which I named because of the resemblance to the Cabrini Green apartments in the movie Candyman. They were the only two cheerleaders within sight of or earshot. Every loop I made, they held up different signs, cheering with all their hearts. Then there was Hatim, screaming at me while on his phone with Gary, who was back at the stands at the finish area. Gary says, "You're doing great, Leah." He says, just keep doing what you're doing. As we approached the halfway point, someone yelled to the pack from the sidelines that we were about 1:18 at the half. That was under my personal best. This would have been really exciting news if I didn't feel so bad. I hadn't fallen off the pace as terribly as I thought, but the pack was starting to thin out. It was go time, and I wasn't ready to go. Now, Had we been at mile 20, I would have dug for that push for the last 10K. Reality was, though, we were only 13 miles in. I thought, I am pushing way too hard to only be halfway. By mile 16, I had that dreadful feeling, this is about to be the longest 10 miles of my life. I passed the team a second time, and he yelled, how are you doing? Are you okay? Good job, Leah. And I knew he must be relaying to Gary on the other end that I was not looking so good as I had the last time. I had a fractional moment of thinking, do I really even have to finish? This isn't going to be the race I wanted. It's not going to be a PR. I'm not going to be anywhere close to making the team. Do I have to? The answer, of course, was damn right you have to. This might be the only Olympic trials I ever ran in, and I was not going home without a medal. I would finish that race if I had to do it on hands and knees. On the final loop, a team was keeping pace with me, running in the grass up on the curb. He kept up with what felt like almost a mile, and I remember thinking, is he sprinting? Or have I slowed down that much that someone on the sidelines can keep up? Then I saw Jesse and Kristen's final loop sign. It said, we love you, no matter what. And I remember thinking, well, that's good, because this is all I got. I've never been so happy to cross the finish line as I was that day. I walked over to the fences that separated the runners from the spectators and met up with some of my friends. We had bright, obnoxious, easy-to-spot Team Zoe shirts made for my friends to wear. One by one, two by two, the Team Zoe shirts started to fill the slope of grass on the other side of the barricade. A boy with a video camera came and asked if he could interview me about the race and about who all these people were. I told them they were my friends and my family and the best support a girl could ever have or hope for. Before long, we broke into a chorus of olés. Olé, 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 olé. That was awesome. This followed by cheers and screams. I might have been the fastest girl out there that day. In fact, I was 55th. But I had so many people there in my shirts, supporting me, loving me. No one could top that. I took a minute to give fence hugs before I was escorted back to my bags and belongings. My mom, dad, and sister were there, along with Gary. I hugged everyone, and finally, I picked up my finisher's medal. I got choked up as I put it around my neck. It was really a beautiful medal, one I would treasure more than any other award I had ever received. I wasn't really ready to talk much. It was a lot to sink in. The whole idea of the big event we'd been preparing for being over, just like that. My family understood this. They told me they'd call me in a few hours and let Gary walk me back to the hotel room. When we got to the room, I saw that my friends Kim and Carl had left a bottle of Bailey's and two cans of Guinness on a bucket of ice. I took a deep sigh, sat down. Gary asked, well, what do you want to do? And though I really wasn't sure, I said, well, we've got to do car bombs. He had shockingly never done one and didn't know what it was. We had to fashion makeshift shot glasses from the mayonnaise and mustard containers left from Kim and Carl's earlier takeout meals. But they worked just fine. Gary and I toasted, threw back the car bombs, and he said, we did it! Yes. Yes, we did. If I could go back and make someone rewrite that headline in the Democrat Gazette, I think it would say, hometown girl makes Arkansas proud at Olympic Trials Marathon. Thank you. Sounds like everybody agrees. I gave my heart and soul that day, and that's all I can ask for.
Thank you so much, Leah Thorvaldsen, for being on the Tin Roof Project here on Tales from the South. For our listeners, Leah just came off a surgery last week to repair a torn tendon, and she is bravely here on her crutches. Pretty impressive.
Ole, 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 ole.
story, you have a great support group. PT and STEM with L&T painted on their chest. Jesse and Kristen with their signs. Hatim, who runs in the grass beside you. And everyone at the finish with the bright green shirts. Do you usually have an entourage at your races? And are there funny stories from other races about this entourage?
How long have you got? Because there are a lot of stories. I don't know if I don't like to call them an entourage, but I've got a family and friends. A lot of them are here tonight. And yeah, we travel to races together. I think I probably piss off some sponsors and elite coordinators sometimes because I'm not the typical, you know, elite who's, you get put in a hotel room with another athlete and you go there and you're real, they have a schedule for you to follow and everything. And I like to show up with my friends and kind of be on my own terms. So yeah, absolutely. We've got Tupelo. Well, is that family friendly? Tupelo? So Tupelo starts with my friend Dan, who's in the crowd at that middle table right there. Green shirt, gray hair. Wave, Dan. Hi. Dan and I have traveled to a lot of races together, and Tupelo Marathon is where we started this. I started a tradition of, it's in August in Tupelo, so it is hot, hot, hot. And I decided the first time we went, I'm going to go escort Dan in, because being by the time it's over 3 or 4 hours, it sucks to be out there. It's hot. The sun is out. It's 90 degrees. So I'm like, I'm going to go escort Dan into the finish. And this became a tradition. Every year, there was beer at the finish, so I'd grab a few beers, and on my way, I'd go back out on the course to escort Dan in. Pause there, and there's another story that started somewhere way long ago. Our whole group has this thing with pickles, and we'll have parties together and talk about bringing little sweet gherkin pickles or dill pickles. And we went up to Fargo Marathon, and I said, well, Dan, I'm going to escort you in on this one, too. What would you like at mile 23? And he said, I want a fistful of pickles right in my face. So I said, well, then, that you shall have. And he did. I got an apron and got my sack of pickles, trotted out on the course, and I threw him right in his face. I was like, you might not think this was as cute an idea now as you did when you told me to do it, but it's happening. So, meshing the two stories together, a couple years ago, I decided, well, I'm going to go escort Dan in again this year, but I want it to be something special. So I made myself a little costume. And it was chaps in a cowboy hat, handcuffs, little pink guns, and a shirt that I wrote Pickle Slinger on the back of. So Dan and I both, actually, I ended up running the shorter race that year, and Dan ended up cutting his race short because he wasn't feeling good. And I said, well, I've got this dang costume. I'm going out on the course to bring somebody in. I don't care who it is. So I've grabbed my friend Charity, who's also here tonight. Happy birthday, Charity, by the way. She's big 2-0 today, almost legal to have a beer. So I grab Charity and get in my costume. We start trotting down the road. About a quarter mile down the road, a cop pulls over. And he rolls down his window and he says, what have you got there, ma'am? I said, beer and some pickles? Am I in trouble? I said, yes, you are. So he gets out of the car, starts taking all the Stanford information, my degree, you know. No. All the standard information. You get name, address, occupation, everything. And he's like, what else have you got? I said, pickles? And he looked at that pickles like it was, I don't know what he thought was in the bag. Takes it, sent it down his trunk. What else do you have, a fake mustache? He takes the mustache away. And then he does this motion like this, turn around. So I thought he was going to frisk me, see what else I've got in my costume. So I turned around and bent over, and he said, I don't think so. And he handcuffed me, put me in the back of the car. Well, I'll just fast forward because I could go into more detail, but by the end of this thing, 5 police cars had pulled up, and I'm in the back of the cop car handcuffed and crying. Poor Charity's outside the car going, what is going on? And I'm going, why do they need 5 cops? Like, what have I possibly done? The 5th one, and they'd all keep asking me the same questions. Do you know why you're in trouble? I guess because I have an open beer. Yes, we have an open container law here in Tupelo, Mississippi, and we might get you on a public intox. So I'm like, I'm not drunk. I've hardly had anything to drink. Well, finally, the final cop gets to the bottom of the story. He says, are you working? And I said, to him, I said, excuse me? I said, are you an entertainer? And I just lost it. And I said, I just won the women's marathon. And they said, well, we don't remember you coming through wearing that. So I said, well, that's funny, because I was actually wearing a lot less. I race in racing briefs that look like underpants and a bra. So eventually, they let me go, and I ended up with a $200 ticket for my open container of beer, because they couldn't possibly have called 5 cops into rural Tupelo and not give me a ticket. So. G-rated enough, I guess.
Musicians, athletes, and riders are a lot alike in that they have pre-race or pre-show rituals. So what are some of yours?
I had one for a long time, and maybe the reason that I'm injured is because I broke it, because I would eat chocolate cake the night before a marathon. It started with my first one. I thought, if I'm going to have a ritual, it's going to be one that I like. Why not make an excuse? Then you have to, you know, you're out of town. Everybody's going to eat pasta or whatever. Nope, we got to go somewhere. I can get my chocolate cake because it's a ritual. And then I have, of course, my lucky pickles, which are on my crutches here. The story for the pickles has kind of already been told. That's where they come from. These ones are terrified. If you want to look at them later, their faces are full of fear. But not too many. I mean, I eat oatmeal the morning of every marathon. I do a warm-up, but nothing strange, nothing real out of the ordinary, other than, you know, set the uniform out the night before, pin your bib on, get your shoes ready.
We have a little time here at the end for audience questions, so if you have a question for Leah, raise your hand and we'll come over to you.
What was your favorite marathon?
I'm so glad you asked. Now, I think with marathons, there's races people like for different reasons. Obviously, Little Rock is really, really special to me because of the hometown feel, and believe it or not, I do love the course. But I've answered this to people a few times. I said, I think if I had to compile statistically something that was ranked on the course being scenic, the course being well organized, it being a race that's great for beginners and elites alike, because some are really only one or the other, and conducive to a fast time, I would say Grandma's Marathon in Duluth, Minnesota.
Leah, you're my hero. And I've yelled that to you quite a few times running on the Little Rock side. I remember you running across the bridge in the 2012 marathon. That was my first marathon. I can never run one again. I've had a hip replacement. But I just want to say you're my hero. And how do you feel about the Little Rock Marathon? Because I think it's an incredible course. Yeah. And I know it's not one that you want to qualify in, but how do you feel about the Little Rock Marathon?
I'm sorry about your hip. My dad's had one too, so it stinks. Just being out for 6 weeks stinks, so I can't imagine. But Little Rock, you know, you mentioned seeing me on the Broadway Bridge, and to kind of tell you how special that is to me, well, last year in 2012, every year the reception for me personally has grown, and I know that I've got fans and that I've got friends in the city, but it shocks me, well, especially the last 2 years. And last year, in 2012, it was so unexpected. The roar in my head, anyway, maybe I'm having illusions of grandeur, but when I came over the Broadway Bridge, the crowd sounded so loud to me, and then I could hear them saying my name. I knew they weren't just inside, that they were out there. For me, I teared up. I mean, I was running, and I was just like, oh, my God. You know, it's hard enough to breathe and to run and kind of go through that, and it was very emotional. And obviously, at the finish line, I can't say what I screamed out loud when I saw, you know, my time. but I was very happy. But this year, although not, you know, the fairy tale ending that I won't even say I'd expected, because I knew going into it, it was highly unlikely to be a good day. But just kind of tell you what Little Rock means to me and how much I appreciate and want to give back. I knew as I went into North Little Rock, things were really starting to get uncomfortable, and I kept thinking, maybe this will go away and it'll start to feel better. You never know. Stranger things have happened in a race. And as I went up the Broadway Bridge on mile 5, obviously the hamstring already had a partial tear in it. I didn't know at the time. I knew I had problems. I didn't know what it was. But going uphill, when you use your hamstring a lot, I could feel my gait was real bad, and I knew going up Kavanaugh Hill, I tried to not think about it, because I thought, ooh, if I make it that far, this is going to be a big problem. But that's where the crowd, or the racers who have started later, and you see a lot of people, and I kind of had in my head, stay in the crowd for the people, stay in the lead for the people of Little Rock, because that's what they want to see. They want to see me win. They want to see me winning or leading. And at the time, I was in the lead, and I knew it was unlikely I was going to hold it. So I just made up my mind to hold it as long as I could, and that's about as long as I did. When the and the people seemed to go forever that day. Like, I love y'all. But in my mind, it was kind of like once you got over the Broadway Bridge and you turned left, that's as long as I remember seeing a huge crowd. They went all the way to mile six, like back down. I'm terrible about remembering streets, but I was kind of like, I'm a little ready to slow down. Like, where's the end of the people? But I waved and I smiled and I made it. But yeah, it's something that it's hard to put into words. Because after last year, I figured it would be kind of like last year, and it was a stronger support and a louder support. And I really have fell in love with the city and couldn't ask for a better support system and family here. Love you too.
Do you have plans for distances longer than a marathon? A lot longer?
No, not really. No. I do. I when I sat with my coach and laid out short-term and long-term goals, one of the goals has always been to, in some form or fashion, put the USA jersey on. And I've had a few people say, I can get you one to wear it. No, I mean, I want a real one that I had to earn. And I think this isn't me putting myself down. I realize that I'm a fairly fast marathoner, but the chances of me at 33 getting from a 237 marathon down to what it takes to make the Olympic team, probably a 222 to 25, are less than slim. But I think looking at some of the 50K, 100K distances, and our friend Chrissy here is a testament to that. She's been there. She's told me. She's threatened me within inches of my life if I don't. No. But yeah, I obviously have got to get healthy and get back running first, but I think that is probably where my best achievements, if I have a full recovery, will happen, because I can't... Michael, I'm thinking of you, hate the word can't. I'm not as adept at going very, very fast. But I can go pretty fast for a long time. Yeah. So I think that that's probably definitely in my future, provided that I recover.
Thank you so much, Leah Thorvaldsen, for being on our Tin Roof Project here on Tales from the South. More can be found out about Leah at her website, leahthorvaldsen.com. So how about our story and storyteller tonight? Thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, with additional support provided by the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio. And you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.